Support for podcasting on KBIA comes from Grindstone Fitness Studio, a full-service gym offering equipment for traditional exercise like weight and cardiovascular training, as well as specialized classes. Choices include personal training, spinning, yoga, Pilates, and more. All classes taught by certified professionals. More information is available at 443-4447, Grindstone Fitness Studio, 3005 Chinaberry Drive in Columbia.
I think we're all searching.
There are some people that think that the media would bias.
It's Wednesday, November 9th, 2011, and this is KBIA's Views of the News. I'm Mike McKean, director of the Futures Lab at the Reynolds Journalism Institute. Here at the table are two of the best analysts at the Missouri School of Journalism, or anywhere for that matter, faculty colleagues Lee Wilkins and Charles Davis. Thanks to those of you who helped KBIA exceed its fundraising goal today, it's reasonably safe to say we'll be around for another year to give you our takes on the performance of the news media. On the agenda this week, we now have faces, names, and a bit of background on two of Herman Cain's accusers. The public appears divided about what it all means. The apparent cover-up of alleged sexual abuse of young boys is bringing down the career and perhaps reputation of one of college football's most revered coaches. It's also raining down media-fueled condemnation on Penn State University's top executive. A well-respected reporter takes on the so-called future of news gurus in a thoughtful piece on the importance of institutional journalists, and we'll offer a few thoughts of our own on what might make for more compelling and useful reporting on the 2012 presidential campaign. Let's begin with the story that for a second week is sucking up most of the political oxygen in this country, the allegations of sexual harassment against Republican presidential candidate Herman Cain. On Monday and Tuesday, we learned the identities of two accusers, one through the efforts of her celebrity lawyer, the other because Rupert Murdoch's iPad news service outed her. In a news conference yesterday, Cain maintained his innocence and attacked the character of 50-year-old Chicagoan Sharon Bialik.
The charges and the accusations I absolutely reject. They simply didn't happen.
Cain's campaign put out the case numbers for a half dozen lawsuits against Bialik, as well as two filings for personal bankruptcy. He called her a liar and troubled.
Now the Democrat machine in America has brought forth a troubled woman to make false accusations, statements, many of which exceed common sense. And they certainly exceed the standards of decency in America.
That clip was from the Today Show, and as we're taping today's program on Wednesday afternoon, the lawyer for the other named accuser, Karen Krausauer of Washington, D.C., announced that Krausauer and Bialik are planning a joint news conference at some point. Meanwhile, Chicago Tribune is revealing a bit of Bialik's background, including two personal bankruptcy filings, and the Associated Press has detailed another workplace complaint by Krausauer 3 years ago against the INS that included reference to a sexually charged internet joke, a complaint that she later dropped. Well, so let's talk about this, Lee. And now that we know the identities of two of the alleged victims, how, if at all, does it change the story that the media are reporting about it?
I think it changes the story in a couple of ways. First off, there's now a face and there's now a person to link with this. And that's got some really positive, some really negative elements because for folks who've been around for a while, people will recall, and Charles and Mike, you both know, that used to be the way that a lot of folks got off from the charge of rape was to attack the character of the victim. And one of the things that tends to happen in this sort of thing is now we get to look at everyone's character, not just Herman Cain's character, but everybody's character. And so we know all of the unsavory things. I don't think personal bankruptcy is unsavory, but I certainly wouldn't like to go through it. And so we sort of know all of these places that make these people human beings and imperfect human beings at that. And I think that gives people who read these stories and see these stories a reason to say, well, they're not truthful. for me, that isn't logical. Just because somebody's declared personal bankruptcy doesn't mean they might not be truthful about this particular allegation. And that's what troubles me about Cain's logic is, you know, he's saying that because these women have led less than perfect lives, therefore they're liars. And I just can't make that one work.
I do think, though, Charles, it's something we've been hoping for in the past week or so, that we would be able to find out the identities, that some of these women would come forward so that we would have at least a more balanced, you know, reporting effort, warts and all. And we do have that now. But I wonder if it matters how the identities of these two women were revealed. In one instance, we have celebrity lawyer Gloria Allred, who probably didn't provide a lot of credibility off the top for her client. And then we have the other woman who was actually outed by The Daily, the iPad news service of Rupert Murdoch. Does it matter how those names came out, you think?
Not in the end, because I think the reading and viewing public forgets that in about 3.2 seconds. I think what's really interesting here is it's always interesting, isn't it? Ideology is just a fascinating thing, because if you take this story and change flip-flop the players entirely, let's say it's a candidate for the Democratic, a wide-open Democratic primary nomination, and four different women come forward in four very different ways to describe four very similar situations. I can't imagine any sentient member of either party that wouldn't go, that's a big problem.
No. It's clearly a story, and I think that we can't fault the media for its focus on it, especially now that we're finding out more of the details. I just wonder, Lee, this latest sort of, you know, promise, I guess, from one of the lawyer for Krauthauer, that the two named accusers are going to come forward and have mm-hmm. a joint news conference. What's the reasoning behind that? Is that likely to occur as far as we can tell? And, you know, what might happen if, in fact, there really is a news conference with these two accusers?
I want to go back to something we were talking about last week, which was really the way I tend to phrase it is it soup yet? Was this a story that was ready to be reported when it actually got reported? And as I'm recalling, one of the things we talked about is in the process of reporting the story, other victims may conceivably come forward. And in a way, that's happened. Now, what the purpose of a joint news conference is really not clear to me, and I have absolutely no knowledge of whether such a thing will happen. I suppose it lends some credence to the people who go, well, this is just a publicity stunt and whatever. On the other hand, there may be an effort at solidarity here that, you know, by people singling themselves out, they sort of get they are it's easier to find troubles with single stories as opposed to what Charles said, which is you've got a lot of very similar scenarios from four very different women, and then you start to look at, okay, what's in common here?
I wonder, Charles, if Krauthauer actually isn't the one who has the more exposure if this happens, because we did learn – bankruptcy, I don't know how you evaluate that or whether it's relevant at all to these accusations. But there was an accusation that Krauthauer filed against her most recent employer before the current one with the INS. And again, it's a complaint about working conditions. There's a reference to a sexually suggestive internet joke in the filing. She drops it later. That seems relevant to the story. To
sure, me. Absolutely. Yeah, because I think it adds to the broader context of who this individual is. The fact that she might be willing and loud about complaining about workplace harassment doesn't mean that workplace harassment didn't happen,
right,
though. And that conflagration that takes place in people's logical wiring is fascinating to me, and I've already seen it on cable television, Blabfest, and other things. Well, this is clearly a litigious person. Not necessarily.
Yeah.
And that complaint, of course, was dropped. I don't know. I mean, I don't sense that this fire is being put out by any means. And when Cain stands up to sort of freeform respond to it, I think he does himself more damage than good. I don't know. I mean, that's the sense I get from watching it. He's really bad at this.
It might suggest why somebody talked him into doing actually a formal news conference and appearance yesterday rather than free form or going on Jimmy Kimmel Live or whatever.
And even that's fairly painful, and I think overall does him more damage than good. The problem is this: a story reaches a certain point like this where you've got four different people talking against the one of you, and there's so much there that it almost reaches a point where we sort of collectively know we're never going to know the whole truth about this. But there's enough scrutiny there and enough criticism there that people reach a point of sort of unease.
Well, let me take us back to the media's performance for just a second. There was an interesting piece by Michael Calderon writing on the Huffington Post on why some of the big news organizations perhaps refused to name names at the beginning of this. There are, you know, the stated concerns about the women's privacy. There were also some news media executives who said, well, you know, we don't really have any clear newsroom guidelines on how to deal with situations like this. But Calderon also quoted an unnamed, anonymously sourced TV news executive who said, you know, hey, basically, if we revealed their names, the likelihood that we'd ever get to interview them goes down to about zero. Perhaps cynical, but I wonder if that isn't at least in the thinking there.
Oh, I'm positive it's in the thinking, as is a lot of other things. I mean, we don't have rules on how to deal with this. Gosh, society doesn't have very good rules on how to deal with this. We're not clear what naming names mean. I mean, one of the current controversies that we'll be talking about, somebody's already lawyered up with a very high-powered libel attorney. And so I'm sort of going, wait a minute, I thought truth was a defense against libel. But now when you've got, you know, big-time lawyers and very deep pockets, that does, I think, I don't know if it has a chilling effect, but it certainly makes you think twice or maybe even three times. And I think all of that's going on in here. I think the other thing is, and Kane did this himself, but if you look at least some of the polls, a lot of people are blaming, oh, this is a media created firestorm, which I honestly, that's logic again that passes me. But he's coming out with a conspiracy theory, which is a really interesting conspiracy theory. I haven't heard this one before, about, you know, whose fault is this really? I think in different contexts, we would call this blame shifting. But until you can figure out a way to point that out, you look more aggressive than you might like.
Charles, I want to take you back to something you said last week, and it was reflected in a piece that was written this week in the Columbia Journalism Review by Erica Fry. I'd suggest that our listeners and viewers take a look at that on our website. The title is Let's Slow Down the Kane Train, but her point was basically that all of these stories are focusing on sort of Kane's missteps in responding to these allegations, but really they're not focusing as they should and as a political journalist should be focusing on what Kane is saying and perhaps misstating about policy. That was your point last week. Or just generally that we ought to be doing more stories right now on the Republican candidates and what they're saying about important issues, not, you know, 99.9% of the focus of the stories being on the sexual harassment allegations.
Right. Yeah. I mean, it's really a perverse thing to say, but this giant Kane story that has swallowed an entire week of coverage has provided really nice political coverage for everybody else who's not ingrained in that story. And so I would imagine if you're Rick Perry or Mitt Romney or Michelle Bachmann, you're going about life as usual, which is you're making policy declarations on a daily basis that are essentially being uncovered. And one can hope that we eventually pivot and that the story sort of runs its course. I mean, it will. It always does, right? But in the meantime, I think she's right. I mean, I think things do get lost. There was a very interesting jobs plan released by the GOP, what, a week ago or something. Go try and find a lot of meaningful coverage of that. There wasn't, because it's just been swallowed by this thing.
I wonder, there's been a little bit of pressure from some people in the media and from others for Kane's wife to come forward and say something about all of this. Should she be under any pressure to do so? Or, you know, are people still looking for that sort of stereotypical stand by your man moment?
I have – oh, dear, Mike, what a question to ask me. I have no idea. But what I can say from sort of an ethics point of view is this is not his wife's problem. I mean, it may be her problem in her marriage,
right.
But it's not her problem. It's not her public problem. He's the person who's there. What information the wife could or could not add, I'm sorry, I say this a lot on this show, it's none of my business. And quite frankly, I don't want to know.
It seems to me that some of the public really don't want to know, or at least don't know a lot about this controversy, despite all the news coverage. There was an interesting poll out this week from the Pew Research Center for the People and the Press, and among other things, they find that 36% really don't know much about this scandal yet, or refuse to say what they know about it. And there's some division about how many people think it's true or false. There's also some interesting analysis of the media, Charles. For example, in this survey, they were asked, the American public was asked, do you think the press coverage of Cain has been too easy, too hard, or just about right? Angie, what would you expect? About 43% say, it's been pretty fair, right down the middle. But that means 50-some percent don't think so. And I wonder what that says at all, if at all, to you.
Well, it says that 50% of the nation are Republicans, I think. I mean, they're going to disagree with that coverage. No, I'm kidding.
It really didn't break down quite that way.
It's really a non-ideological thing, I think. I mean, in study after study, when asked, about half the American people think the press is fundamentally dishonest over and over and over again, regardless of story, really. You could drop in Herman Cain or you could drop in the World Series. And there is such press loathing among roughly half the electorate that you wonder if it's not just reflexive at this point. Like, does it have anything to do with the story, or is it just the word, the media or the press just automatically generates that reaction?
Yeah, Lee, I think you saw that in the other poll that we have listed on our website, which was done by a company that was started by a former CNN executive. And basically, the response was that I think it was 64% of registered voters who were questioned agreed with Herman Cain that, quote, the media is downright dishonest. Is it just reflexive, as Charles said? Is there more to it than that?
I think some of it's dishonest. I mean, I'm old enough to remember Agnew's nattering nabobs of negativism, which
right.
I can still say with a straight face. And so I think some of it, I do think some of it's reflexive. But again, I don't like the question that the pollster asked, because as best I can figure out, other than the initial story, which I believe deserved to be reported, we've done nothing except say, he said, he continued to say, he said yet again, or she said,
right.
Or as, you know, I mean, how does that make us dishonest?
There's been some even more, I guess you could say, troubling allegations of sexual abuse this week that are rocking one of the country's premier universities. We learned today, for example, that Penn State football coach Joe Paterno is going to step down at the end of this season, if he makes it that far, because of allegations that he didn't do enough to stop a former assistant, Jerry Sandusky, who's accused of sexually molesting several boys as young as 8 years old. While the local and national media have really been putting Penn State in the crosshairs the past couple of days, including the president of the university, Graham Spanier. Reporters such as ESPN's Joe Schott are already speculating about who will replace Spanier.
He was at least briefed on these sexual allegations. And so what I'm told is being discussed is the possibility of Spanier being replaced. And in fact, one name as a possible replacement has already been brought forward. A name who has support in the community is Tom Ridge, the former director of Homeland Security, the former governor of the state of Pennsylvania. So that is something that at this time is being discussed as a possibility.
We'll see if that happens. I mean, ESPN is sometimes on these kinds of stories as wrong as often as they're right. But there is a lot of speculation going on. And I guess I'm wondering, Charles, just at least to get this conversation started, should we really be surprised that it took so long for these allegations to come to light? They date all the way back to 1998. There was apparently a detailed account in 2002 from a graduate student who says he personally witnessed this sexual molestation of a young boy in the showers at a Penn State athletic facility. Why so long for this story to surface?
Wow. I've thought about that because it is staggering. The bad luck probably that it would take at so many different levels for that story to not reach the light of day, for somebody not to give it to somebody, for someone not to have mentioned it in passing to someone who in turn mentioned it in passing to someone else. It's remarkable. And then at the same time, it's perfectly understandable because sex crimes, particularly sex crimes involving children, don't happen in an ecosystem of transparency. They happen in an ecosystem of cloister and secrecy and darkness. Happy Valley as well is the kind of place where I'm not saying there's anything intensely negative about Happy Valley. Don't get me wrong, Penn State people, but it's a small community. It's one of the smaller academic communities with a very large university in it in the country. And it's the kind of place where people look out for one another, where the athletic department reigns supreme, and where something like this, if it's going to happen, it can happen in an academic community like that because, as we all know, the reporting channels tend to drop at some point. They end. They reach a sort of point of finality, and that's it. If this were taking place regularly in another institution without the complicity of somebody at the very top, it wouldn't stay secretive.
Yeah. You know, I think, Lee, aside from the obvious nature of the allegations themselves, which, as Charles said, they're just horrible, really disturbing, the media coverage pretty quickly turned from that to the top Penn State pyramid, right? The coach, Joe Paterno, some of the individuals that were charged in this, including the former assistant coach, but also the president of the university, Graham Spanier. And I'm just wondering, you know, if this seems like a natural course of events for the story to go to the top rather than to focus on the allegations themselves at this early stage in it.
One of the things that's going on here is that no one appears to be disputing the allegations. You've got grand jury testimony. You've got a lot of things that sort of lend, I want to say, weight and credence to those allegations. And in fact, I gather from what I've been able to discern so far today that there are more victims who are coming forward.
Yeah.
So I think that, I mean, every once in a while you get a story that makes you look in the mirror really, really hard. And this has been one of those for me because the discussion that I've heard is that Paterno did, and the graduate student before, did what they were legally required to do. They reported it up. And I'm going, where is that legally required? If I see a crime, especially this sort of a crime, my obligation as a citizen, forget that I'm a faculty member or forget that I go to a particular church or that I take my daughter to a particular dance studio or whatever it happens to be, my obligation is to call the cops and tell the cops what I know. And so Charles says this is bad luck, and I suppose in a way it is, but I think in another way it's a case of profoundly confused loyalties by people who are confusing their loyalties to the university, and goodness knows there are many reasons to be loyal to the university, with their loyalty and their solidarity with humanity writ large, especially kids.
By the bad luck, I just mean it's staggeringly unlikely that someone wouldn't have felt the moral duty to report at that point, and to have that many people who were in possession of that knowledge to then make the clearly wrong moral choice over and over and over again is amazing.
And I have no inside knowledge about this at all. I'm merely speculating, but I'm actually worrying whether the other shoe is going to drop and we're going to find out that some journalists in the area or some former players knew about this for some time and didn't report it too. I also wonder, though, Charles, we say nobody sort of challenged the allegations yet, but do we at all need to apply some of the lessons we learned from that Duke lacrosse rape allegation case, because we really jumped on something that looked like, you know, all the evidence was there and the whole house folded there?
Sure. I mean, we still have to be skeptical, always skeptical. But here the evidence seems to be historical, voluminous, repetitive. I mean, that was a one night situation, the Duke lacrosse thing, that was a very much a conflicting testimony situation where you had an accusation leveled and someone denying it, a group of guys denying it from the get-go. Here, very different factual scenario.
Yeah. I also think it's kind of interesting that where we have sort of the traditional media covering this story, and to a pretty large extent, I'd say pretty well, we also have this interesting situation with these new networks that have formed, like the Big Ten Network, which is mostly a PR machine between the conference and entities like Fox Sports in this instance, or with the Longhorn Network, ESPN. Is it any surprise that they are not covering this story with the same level of detail or aggression that the traditional media are?
Well, I think there's two levels of that. One is there's a lot of self-interest involved. But secondly, these are new places, and they don't have the journalists with a kind of chops, even the ESPN journalists with a kind of chops, to be willing to go after this story. I also have to say that based on my relatively brief look at the web that some of the best reporting I've seen done is actually coming from local news outlets that I think are trying very hard to ask the skeptically informed questions to say, well, is this really true? And who else might have known? And, you know, and it's obvious to me that there were, as much as I want to ding the people at Penn State, and I really do want to ding them, but there were also these kids' parents who in some ways were informed, even though these were high-risk kids. And so there's enough blame to go way, way, way around here.
The other thing, while we're blaming people, the scene outside of Mr. Paterno's house yesterday in which he was accosted by a bunch of TV reporters was definitely not a very bright moment for the press. That was embarrassing.
I'm going to skip over the third item that we promoted because there's no way we have about 4 minutes left that we're going to get to it. Maybe we'll bring it up next week, and you can certainly read it on our blog, which was an article called The Confidence Game. It really deserves a lot more attention than we're going to give it now, so we'll try to bring it back. But I do want to talk about the final item that we had on our agenda, which is, I hope, something more positive and life-affirming than the two previous topics. And that we're getting into the serious part of the presidential campaigns. We're going to be having the caucuses and primaries in less than 2 months now. And so let's just talk a little bit about what we would like to see that would be more inspiring, uplifting, useful, whatever word adjective we want to use, coverage of the presidential campaign. And we'll start with you, Lee.
I don't know if this is inspiring or uplifting, but useful probably. I would like to see political advertising covered as an actual news story. And by that, I don't just mean ad watches, although I do mean that. But I mean getting people in the community to cooperate with journalists to say, here's all the direct mail advertising I got this week, and here is what it said. To actually monitor different channels where advertising is going out to, this is going to get folks mad, actually go into churches and cover what's being said in the pulpit on Sunday and to act like that is what it is, which is basically political speech, and to treat it as such. Those are things that I think we're going to desperately need.
Charles, what would you like to see, at least one area where journalists could do a better, a more, you know, I don't know, concentrated job of political
reporting? I love that question, and I thought about it all morning long. And one of the things I came up with was this widget, which I want to get the Wunderkinds at RJI working on right away, which would allow, when you come across a reference to an assertion of popular support for a position, would sort of pop up and allow you to immediately assess that against polling data. Because I see things right and left every day in which people assail the policy positions of one another, when if you look at the backdrop of American public opinion, vast swaths of the public agree on a lot of things. And I would love to – maybe we call it the consensus widget or something, because you see people talk about the absolute overall negative support for healthcare. Not true. Yeah. Right. I mean, you look at it, there's a broad consensus. If you take the broad outlines of the Health Care Act and you peel away the rhetoric and the anger, there's a lot of support out there for a lot of the provisions of it. And we could say the same thing about guns, and we could say the same thing about abortion. And I don't know, maybe just a reminder that we all don't hate each other would be kind of helpful.
While we're talking about technology, I'd like to see a widget kind of along the lines of what Nate Silver from the New York Times did this past week, where he got the interactive staff to put together this graphic that you can take three basic assumptions about the presidential election and basically determine whether or not it's likely that Obama is going to win or one of his rivals is going to win. And despite the headlines that say, is Obama toast, the real outcome of his scenarios was basically pretty much a 50-50 split. There was a similar kind of concept back during the 2008 campaign where USA Today did a really great little game online where you could compare your opinions and your intensity of opinions about various issues with those of Obama and John McCain and get a sense, sometimes surprisingly, of where you came down vis-a-vis the positions of the other candidates. So more gaming is probably going to be a real interesting use of this upcoming campaign season. Well, with that, we're going to have to let it go for this week. Thanks to Lee and Charles, as always, and also to our technical crew, RJI's Travis McMillan, KBIA's Pat Akers, and student producer Ryan Williams. We'd love to hear from you, your questions, your comments, topic suggestions. You can do that by email, views@kbia.org. Or you can go to the talk shows menu on KBIA.org and click on the Views of the News tab. You can also find audio, video, and story links there.
I'm Mike McKean. Charles Lee and I invite you back again next Wednesday for another edition of KBIA's Views of the News.